Hey folks, welcome to episode 6 of the Brief Encounter podcast with me, Johnny Boyle. On this episode, I have Irish drummer Dave Hingerty, who's currently working on his Side 4 collective. It's a very special and unique project because generally in the creative process, drum beats and arrangements and guitar parts generally stem from a songwriter presenting a song. This whole project was built up from the drums. And it features some unbelievable talent, people such as Paul Noonan from Bell X1, Katy Perry's drummer Adam Marcello, Carol Kyo, Josh Ritter, Robbie Malone, Connor Brady, Ben Castle and Farrah L. Dave, I've always seen Dave as a real Renaissance man. He's a great musician, very creative guy, superb photographer, and he's played with bands such as The Frames, played with Paul Brady. Josh Ritter is currently playing with Brona Gallagher. So in this podcast, we talk about his project. We talk about how the whole project came about, how he got people involved. We also share some stories about what it was like being in The Frames, as we've both been in that band for some time. And we also talk about his career as a photographer and a variety of topics. It's quite a heartfelt conversation, I have to say. And I really enjoyed talking to Dave in these very crazy times. But I think what's really nice about it is that we were both extremely optimistic. So hope everybody's safe out there. Keep the faith, stay busy, mind your head, and we'll all be playing music again soon. So I hope you like this podcast. Take it easy, guys. Dave-o, here we go.
So
I suppose, okay, so we're here to talk about the Side 4 Collective, right? So I suppose my first question to you would be, what gave you the incentive to do it? Was it a kind of, you got up one day, or was it something you've been thinking about for a long time?
I think it's because I had recorded probably hundreds of beats over the last 10, 15 years on my phone. And I just didn't know what to do with them, you know. Yeah. I when I practice drums, I feel that the main part of my practice is to see what ideas I can come up with, you know. Mm. Not to necessarily better myself as a drummer, you know. I'm technically not great, I would say. But ideas-wise, I feel like I'm pretty good. So if I have a little bit of technique, I seem to be able to get a decent amount of ideas from that.
Sure.
So I want to, I always like to record my ideas, whatever kind of unusual grooves or a weird sound that might come up. So I put it down on the phone, and I had this big collection of beats. Didn't know what to do with them, you know. And it was almost like I wasn't getting enough sessions to, I suppose, express myself, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe that was one thing. And also the sessions that I was getting, I wasn't allowed maybe to be creative enough, or else I was stopping myself being expansive or creative in my drumming, you know. Maybe I was in the wrong band, who knows. Yeah. I remember when I was with Josh Ritter, I was playing very, very simple stuff, and creatively it was doing nothing for me, even though I loved him, the music and the band and the touring, everything about it. But musically, or from a drumming point of view, there wasn't any creativity there, really.
Sure, yeah.
And that's why I took up photography on the road. But just to get back to the point, it's just that need to be creative, you know. And I suppose I had all these unusual, strange beats, and I thought, well, I put them together in a folder. I bumped into Anthony Gibney, who had been working in the States in Electric Lady Studios in
Ladyland,
New York.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, here's a gem of a person who's just come back to Ireland and nobody really knows him, and he's just setting up, really. So the two of us put our heads together. And he wanted to get more traffic into his studio. I wanted to get more work as a session player. So we thought, why don't we just set up a folder of these crazy beats, re-record them in his studio with all the different drum kits that I have from the different eras, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties. Mm. And send them out to friends, musicians that I had met over the years and contacts, and allow them to layer ideas up over the drum beats, you know. So, I mean, I don't know if those listening know that the whole idea behind side four is to kind of turn the tables on the conventional songwriting form. So normally the songwriter will begin and the musicians kind of fall in behind with their ideas. That's regular. But this was the opposite. You had to write a song or a piece of music with the drum beat being the start point, you know. It's the first point of writing. But I never insisted that the beats had to stay in the song or that it couldn't be mashed up or changed or anything like that. But that was the first point, that these weird drum beats were the thing that inspired a song, you know, and that's where the first album arrived from. But, I mean, the whole thing, I suppose, is just as an excuse. There's a little bit of ego in there, you know.
Well, I've from knowing you for a long time, I always find that you're someone who kind of is very creative by nature. And, you know, my perception would be that this was something you had to do as well, because, you know, just before we did this interview, I was looking at your website and, you know, I call you the Renaissance man, because the fact that, you know, you play so well, you're incredibly creative with all the people you work with, but also as a photographer, you're a very accomplished photographer as well, you know, and I love black and white. I love the way you shoot photographs, you know, and obviously all the people you've worked with over the years, all the bands. You're teaching. I mean, you set up one of the first kind of drum schools in Dublin, and now obviously we're working together in BIM. Mm-hmm. But I suppose going back to the album as well. So when these ideas started to gestate, was there a lot of arranging to do once people started to layer stuff? Did you have to kind of take it then and kind of, I suppose, deconstruct it?
Yeah, but not too much. I didn't want to, affect what they were obviously proud of, their contributions, which were always incredible. So I felt like I didn't want to be blocking anything, any creative process, quite the opposite. So I allowed so much freedom, you know. I mean, I was really an anti-producer, if anything. And I was trying not to get in the way, and I was just trying to allow people enjoy layering stuff over the beats. You know, they didn't have to be conventional songs. That was the good thing about it. Mm. They could just be something that started at the end or ended at the start or had made no sense whatsoever. I didn't mind what shape it took, you know.
Yeah.
So no, I didn't really get over involved. And Anthony Gibney, again, as the person who recorded and mixed a lot of the stuff, has to take great credit, as do the artists. A lot of them recorded at home to the drum beats with their home studios, but a lot of them also came out to the studio with Anthony. And honestly, I just sat there and ate sandwiches and kind of just nodded and let Anthony do all the work, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was great. It was great fun. And I think everybody enjoyed that freedom, you know? And, you know, obviously, if there was a little, an idea here or there which I felt would work well, or a little melody that I could add on like a bass line or a glockenspiel or something, I would add it in, you know? Mm. But there was a lovely sense of freedom to the project. And just going back to the beats themselves, like, and that creative thing, I always felt like growing up that, I was nearly a bass player, and then I was nearly a percussionist, and then I ended up with the kit. And I always feel like that I'm not really a regular drum kit player. I'm more like a weird mix of a bass player and a percussionist who actually happens to be sitting in a drum kit with a pair of sticks in his hand. Very unconventional. And I'm left-handed, sitting at a right-hand kit. So I think when people employ me, they can't expect a normal drummer to be sitting behind the kit, you know. Very much, I'm not.
But that's an element. The fact that you play open handed, adds a certain uniqueness to your style. I mean, you know, obviously, like Ringo used to play right handed, but he'd lead with his left hand when he played fills. But obviously, your dexterity around the kit would be very different to say a right handed player, because we're kind of the fact that you have that freedom of the open handed. There's more freedom to kind of get around the kit, I suppose, or just. You know, different voicings where you can kind of create very original beats and stuff like that.
And it makes you question the whole setup of the drum kit. We have accepted the conventional way that a drum kit is set up, but, you know, and I know people invent different ways, but it's good for people, if there's drummers out there or musicians in general, to change their setup in order to arrive at new creative ideas, you know, just to completely switch the position of drums to see what sounds they come up with. Like, I mean, I obviously play the guitar up. I can't play guitar, but I just noodle around and the strings are upside down. Mm. But if ever I come up with the melody, it seems to be a little bit unusual or strange because I'm approaching it with the strings upside down. So I would even say to guitarists, string your guitar like a left-handed guitar and see what scales that you come up with, because they're going to be, they won't make any sense to what you normally play, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's good to, I mean, that's true of any walk of life. I think if you're in a rut, or, you know, say you're an actor, or even if you're working in a bank or anything, like you could, it's very easy to get into a rut with whatever you're doing. So I think it's important to change up your approach and how you sit in front of your work, you know, just change anything, just one element, and see what new ideas can come from.
So, I mean, reinvention to some degree.
Yeah.
Well, let's look at our buddy Graham Hopkins. I mean, when I look at the way Graham plays now to the way he played 20 years ago when he was in therapy, he's kind of very much embodies that Levon Helm kind of feel. And I always felt like he's reinvented himself as a player over these last few years.
Maybe he's come full circle, because I know his dad was a jazz drummer, and maybe he, I don't know how he grew up. Was he a rocker from the start?
Well, I suppose he was affiliated with My Little Funhouse and Therapy, yeah, and those kind of bands, Boss Valenti, whereas, you know, I suppose maybe from playing with Glenn Hansard over the last few years, and
yeah,
obviously Glenn's style would be very different. And
he's just getting old and soft.
Well, I think we're all getting a bit older. I'm even slow. I can't play as fast as I used to play, you know what I mean? Because there was that thing when you were younger. It was like, everyone wanted to play like Jimmy Chamberlain or Chad Smith, or, you know, and I think that's what separated you from a lot of people as well, because, as you say, as a percussionist and a bass player, and I think your taste in music as well, you very much, you know, I remember seeing you playing a Music Maker doing like New Orleans grooves. You know, I'd never heard those before.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I know you'd be heavily influenced by like, you know, Fela Kuti or Tony Allen and people like,
yeah,
that, you know, and a lot of that style of music kind of, I'm not saying, you know, went over my head, but definitely through my teens, I was more into the alternative rock scene and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
But I do, my taste is changing as well, and I'm kind of mellowing out. But I think as well, I've kind of found my niche in the sense that I just enjoy working with songwriters. You know, and I think that's, if you can kind of help them realize their vision to some degree,
yeah,
and kind of walk away from a session feeling good about yourself, I mean, it's very satisfying.
It is, you know, it really is.
I just did a record with a guy called John Murray, and John Parrish produced, and, you know, I played stuff on that record, I'm just completely out of my skin. But because I was there in Rockfield Studios with a producer, you know, I was so enthralled to be there and excited.
Out of your skin, as in you played well, or you were uncomfortable?
No, I was so comfortable, but yeah. I had this real urgency to please and do my best and work really. And we put in long days. And actually, what ended up happening was myself and John, the singer, we just pretty much tracked like the songs. So the songs kind of, and we went in with no pre-production, so 4 or 5 days later we came out with about 8 or 9 songs.
Yeah.
So, and then they obviously went and overdub, but it was just a wonderful experience for me, and I think I'm starting to get more comfortable in my own skin as a player. There's a real insecurity I think we have as musicians. Do you know what I mean? And like, I'm looking online now, and obviously we're very involved with the younger generation of players, and they're all striving to play a certain way.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that way is in another 3 years is going to go out of fashion, and there's going to be another way everyone's going to play.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, and I'm kind of thinking, hopefully what I do comes back into fashion at some point. You know, but to still be doing it, that's the other thing. We're like, you know, we're both still doing it. And I think, obviously, we're living under this.
What are the chances? I mean, you know, really, I look back over my music career, and I obviously feel very, very, very lucky. But I think I'd love to know the percentages of people who go into music. It's such an insecure industry, as you say.
Yeah.
And I think some people, including the government, can take it for granted, you know, and take the great talent that is in this country, for example, take it for granted. And, you know, you see streaming places like Spotify as well, also taking us all for granted. And it's very hard to make a living, and you'd wonder what percentage has made a living, you know, or what percentage do. I'd love to see the figures, and I'd love to see, and that's what causes a lot of insecurities, I think, for the musicians. They just don't feel, every day they wake up worrying about their future and about whether they can make ends meet, you know, and it's not fair in an environment, you know, and it's not the way to treat these marvelous talents that are in the country, you know. Somehow we have been lucky, or else we've been crafty, yeah, or we've been resilient, or we've been stupid, or I don't know what we've been, but yeah, we've stuck with it, you know.
Yeah.
And it's so difficult, you know. And even now I feel a bit vulnerable, you know. I don't know if it's the COVID thing or something, or whether it's my age, because is it an age-related industry? You know, is it ageist? Is this, you know, we're teaching all these great drummers coming through BIM. Are we teaching them to take our work? You know, that's something that I think about a lot.
It's kind of happening to me already.
Yeah.
You know, particularly in the corporate kind of wedding scene, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because that's very business orientated as well. And mm-hmm, let's face it, you know, a lot of people just learn to play an instrument and just move straight into covers. Or, yeah, you know, and they end up playing for money at a young age. And that's fine. If that's what somebody decides, I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
The covers and the corporate scene, well, there was no corporate scene during the recession, but weddings. I thought weddings were like bulletproof because, you know, I lost my house in the recession. But thankfully, because I was playing with a wedding band, which that was never my goal as a drummer to do that. But when I have two kids, it was a necessity. It was born out of necessity. And I did it and it got me through the recession. And now all of a sudden I'm sitting here and I've no gigs. I haven't played in four or five months. Look, you know, I don't know if you've played. I know you've done a couple of studio sessions.
Yeah.
But I haven't played and I have not
been playing. And sorry to cut across you, but I was thinking about it on the way to this interview, and I was thinking about how it's affected me not playing every day. There's something I think that ever since I was 14 when I started playing drums, it's like I'm addicted to it and I need it, you know. Yeah. And I haven't been drumming, I haven't been practicing or anything.
Me neither.
So on the one half, it's a very physical thing. I need it for my system, for my body, for my functioning day to day. And also from a point of view of being in a room with musicians, that interaction I've been missing as well. Yesterday I was in the studio with Jane Willow and band. And it was one of the best days I've had for a long, long, long time, many, many months. And it's something that would have happened loads of times over the years that I would have taken for granted. But yesterday it felt really special because it's something that I've been missing so much. I think everybody's the same in this COVID atmosphere. Everybody's sort of isolated within themselves. They're kind of doing a lot of navel gazing, staring at their own life, seeing how they are, seeing how what things they might like to change, you know, and also trying to self-motivate every day, whether it's painting the house or learning a new skill or trying to find ways of staying fit or not going to the fridge and eating their faces off. Everybody's trying to self-motivate.
Yeah.
Whereas yesterday I didn't need to self-motivate, Johnny. I just went into the studio and immediately all this sort of chemistry of ideas was happening around me. And I wasn't in my own head anymore. I was playing my drums. I was happy out. And I didn't have to self-motivate. Everybody was motivating each other, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what's been missing in my life the last few months, you know? Yeah. And to a point where I was really, like, it was affecting my mental health and everything, you know?
I'm sure that's rampant as we speak.
Yeah.
You know, I know a lot of people that have mortgages and they haven't gigged for 5 months and they're worried. People are worried.
Yeah.
And I actually think there's a lot of insensitive comments towards our industry that are being, you know, mentioned by our politicians. They don't understand our industry.
Yeah.
But
you hear, wasn't there one yesterday?
Well, the thing, Heather Humphreys came out with this statement about, you know, well, maybe it's time for you to upskill or you know, retrain yourself. And now, in fairness, in her defense, somebody made a very good point. They said, well, she never said musicians. And all the musicians now have jumped on the bandwagon saying, well, I've been a musician for 30 years and I'm not going to retrain. And how dare you? But you didn't actually say musicians.
Okay.
You know, maybe you're, I don't know. Like, I you know, maybe you were, well, I don't want to mention an occupation because I don't want anybody's occupation to sound lesser than what we do. Do you know what I mean? Every job is relevant because that's what puts food on the table and a roof over your head. So I don't think anybody's more important or less important. A lot of people are suffering and I think it's the uncertainty, but, you know, I think a lot of people will pack it in as well. I think a lot of people.
Right.
But I also think on an
more work for us.
More work for us. Yeah, maybe the old guys will get back in.
Yeah.
You know, but I think this has been a great opportunity for me to just reflect a little bit on kind of some of the things that have been bugging me for a very, very long time. Yeah. I now have an opportunity to just cut them out of my life, which is great.
Like what?
Well, let's say there might be people I don't necessarily want to play with anymore.
Good.
So or, you know, not just for my own reasons, because yeah. And then I'm kind of thinking, well, you know, I remember at one point in my life I was doing 180 gigs a year. I was working in the college with you a few days a week, studying for my postgrad. My dad was in and out of hospital. That's for right. 5 or 6 years, and I just had all, and I'm raising two kids, and it just all, I've no idea how I didn't have a mental breakdown. I came close at one point. I did come close before I moved up to this area about 10 years ago.
And what was key to helping you there? Sorry, it's just at the forefront of everyone's minds. I think this mental health, and you see even the FA Cup final. Sorry, I'm a big football fan, but I think that was sponsored by a big mental health movement, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's now is a good time for everybody to have a look at how we can help each other in that regard. So, and I'm always keen to see... What was the turning point for you? Like, what was the thing that helped you to get through all of those different things that you're having to deal with?
I think what happened to me was I spent 12 years on the road, like just touring, touring, touring with a variety of acts and people. And it just kind of stopped. My last touring gigs with the Frames. So, yeah. You know, we'll talk about that later.
We will.
Because I came in after you, obviously.
Yeah.
And it was just all of a sudden, after 12 years of just not having to deal with very much, really, I just came home and all of a sudden I had two small kids, and I had them 5 days, I had them every day. My wife was working, and I just, and it's that thing of like, you know, is my career over now? And I was making a few quid, playing some weddings and stuff, but, you know, again, it's a knock to your ego. Because you start to feel like you're worth less, because you're like, hold on a minute. 2 years ago, I was playing like Marley Park to 20,000 people.
Yeah.
Now I'm at a wedding where you don't even make eye contact with anyone.
Oh,
and it's a different existence. But I had some personal issues maybe from when I was a teenager that I'd never really addressed. And that everything just kind of culminated. And we were living in a small house on top of one another with a second kid. And so where we are today, I found a house, and I thought, well, a new house will be a fresh start.
Great.
You know, and that made a huge difference to us. It was a fresh start and things were good. I mean, look, you know, marriage is up and down.
Yeah.
Having kids is stressful, working. But definitely for a long time, I was just doing too much, you know, and as a result of that, you burn yourself out.
But that's great that you found the turning point, you know, and you were proactive about it, because I think that's what we all need to do, because we can get into trouble and we can be self-analytical and too analytical, especially in these COVID times, you know. I think to a certain extent, you can't take too many conclusions from a period like this. Like, if you are looking at yourself and probably too hard in some ways for 3 months, and you come to certain conclusions, I think it's best to relax a little bit off that and just to think that it's very extraordinary times, and don't necessarily, you don't have to come to those conclusions. That is necessarily correct what you're thinking at the moment. Just wait till things to get normal again and see how you still feel about that, you know.
Yeah,
I think that's important.
I'm happy to, you know, for me, I've made a decision of what I want to do for the next year. And to be honest, it's what it is about, again, is just about putting food on the table and keeping a roof over my head and being able to pay our bills. Because there's a lot of people like that are, their money's going to go down to 200 euros a week, and they've got kids. And, you know, people can't survive on that, you know, particularly when there's the uncertainty of not knowing when you're going to go back to work.
Yes, yeah.
So,
and that, I suppose, that goes back to the minister and why she was a little naively, trying to be helpful, I think, but she was saying that we should try and find another skill, to develop. Now, in a way, I have been doing that a little bit, because I was starting to learn how to video edit, because I realized that, you know, a lot of stuff is happening online, and maybe it would help to have that skill, even as a drummer, if I could say that. Not only can you employ me as a drummer, but I can make a video of the studio session as well, if you like, or the gigs, or the tour,
or whatever.
So I can provide that skill as well, if you're giving me a few extra bob.
Hey, you know.
And I've been enjoying that new learning curve. So to a certain extent, she has a point, but at the same time, it's the way you word it, you know, because you have to say, listen, I assume that you are already a very skilled purveyor of your art and you don't need to hear this, but it might be wise just to be as flexible as possible for the next while. And if you do have time, so there's a kind way of sending out this message from the government, I think.
Yeah.
It's eggshells time. It's just, unfortunately, the government do need to continue to sort of tread carefully, you know. And I think that's especially the case with musicians, you know, because we were already feeling insecure before something like a pandemic came along, you know.
Yeah.
Just by it's the nature of the job that you don't know if you'll have a job next week.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, would you say that 70% of people who do have a job would be secure in thinking that they probably would have that job in a year's time? Is that naive of me to say? But we certainly don't even know if we... I mean, my diary's empty next month.
Oh,
It's empty next year.
Yeah.
It's empty at Christmas. And that's always been the way I've lived. I've lived like that for 30 years, where my diary, not all the time, but my diary, when I look, my old file of facts from the 80s, yeah, that I still have, I open it and there's tumbleweeds and it can be empty. But then suddenly it fills up and then it always seems to fill up. And actually it always seems to fill up with the exact same amount of gigs and a wide variety of wonderful stuff and great things happen. So I've learned to be not panicky about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's very precarious.
It is. I mean, for me, it's about just trying to create a bit more balance. I think as people in any job you're in now, expectations are really high in any job you're in.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like, you know, if you're working for Google, a friend of mine worked for Facebook, you know, and he'd be leaving at 6 o'clock and there'd be people going, oh, are you leaving? Are you going? Yeah, I'm employed from 9 till 6 because now they have the canteen there and you can eat there and there'll be people staying there till 9 o'clock at night and all of a sudden, well, I'm staying till 9.
Are you not as dedicated as me?
It's almost like this Scientology, well, you know, just religious kind of, oh, you're leaving, are you? You know, it's like this is
a cult as well as work.
I've seen it in some of the work I do as well where people are, you know, kind of chipping away. But look, that's what you kind of have to do. I think as well in our industry, like we were saying earlier, there's younger guys coming up and like, I know my value as a player. And if Diageo want me to do a gig in the RDS and I'm being
D'Angelo
told,
preferably.
Well, you know, but if it's a corporate gig and I'm being told, well, we can only pay you half wages. Well, I'm not doing it for that. Are the riggers doing it for half wages? Is the guy working behind the bar, is he doing it for half wages? Is it like, I'm not doing it for that. Mm. So I essentially have to turn down work. But this is the whole...
That's very principles, yeah.
Well, that whole side of the... But the thing is the younger guys that I bring in, oh, they'll jump at the chance.
They will.
But what I'm trying to say is, lads, not only are you undercutting me, you're completely undervaluing what you do.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, guess what? In 3 years, you're going to be on half wages for every gig. And you won't be getting the going rate. And you're going to be unhappy. But it's grand when you're living at home at 30 years of age. But when you actually want to go and have a life, you know... And
it's funny because I feel like, you know, most people's wages have increased with inflation, naturally. Like, there's no way that somebody who works, again, in a bank, just for an example, is on the same wages as they were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
There's no way. The price of living, you know, but I'm still getting kind of the same gig and the same teaching fees, the same gig money. And it's very strange because I look back at some old gigs and, you know, if I'm getting 250 quid for a gig 15 years ago, I'm still getting 250 quid a gig. And actually, it might even decrease, you know, coming up for the exact reason that you're saying.
Yeah.
Because there's young, hungry players who are willing to do it for less, you know.
Yeah.
And actually mainly because we've taught them so well, they're very, very slick professionals, you know. Good technicians as well as having a great attitude, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Not all of them now, but the pick of the crop.
Yeah.
And I find that I don't think I've become a better drummer at all in the last 10 years, but I noticed that my attitude towards professionalism has changed, you know. Mm. I was famously laissez-faire. We might talk about the Frames and the breakup and why I wasn't in the Frames anymore. I don't mind talking about that because I think that's interesting for people to hear. But Sorry, I lost my train of thought there. It's obviously an emotional thing for me.
Ah, yeah. Well, no, but as you're saying, younger people growing up, and you know, they're obviously ambitious as well. You know, younger people have ambition.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah, that's
and,
right.
And they want to play. And
yeah, but they don't know what it's like to be unprofessional. I was probably a little. I didn't have a great attitude towards professionalism. But because I was teaching young players how to be professional, I thought, well, I have to be as well, you know?
Yeah.
So I have improved that side of my approach towards playing. Like even yesterday, I was in the studio, as I said, and I was starting to look at my phone a little bit, you know, and I was realized that mental activity of looking at my phone is replacing me looking at notes for the next song that I know is coming up, that I need to be mentally rehearsing the bridge, the changes, all the stuff that's going to happen in the song, because we were doing 8 songs in one day and I had to be on the ball for every single song, and I had to have my phone because I was listening back to rehearsal stuff for ideas that I came up with in the rehearsal. So I was using my phone, but then I was having a little sneaky look at the social platforms, having a look at my emails, and I thought, stop, yeah. Dave. Like, you have to be as good as the best young player who probably is putting his phone away if he's really, really on it. And or maybe Johnny Boyle's sitting in the studio somewhere else and he's not on his phone. So I have to be at my very best, you know, professionally.
Yeah.
So I stopped. I did stop and I put the phone away. And then I picked it up again a couple of hours later. I'm like a junkie for it, you know.
We all are. And it's such a shame because, you know, I remember being in the Temple Bar, like the Temple Lane studios. So yeah. This is like 90... Oh, jeepers,
19th century.
89, yeah, like 1989, 90. But, you know, anytime I went in there, anytime I was loading in, it was like Lear. Lear had a room in there and they were just always playing. Oh, Lear's in there again. You just always, there was just music coming out of that room.
Endlessly.
And I'm sure it was the same for you when you went in with your band. You just played. There was no distractions.
Yeah.
Like, nobody was reading a newspaper. You know what I mean? Or you know.
Stop because you were hungry now and again. But
that
that's
was
about it.
A cup of tea or whatever. You put the work in. Jimmy Chamberlain, when we had him in BIM the last time, that's what he said. When the Pumpkins went into rehearsal, there was no phones. And I think I would say that's something you'll see introduced, is like you put your phone in a...
Yeah.
In a bag when you go in and you don't touch it.
Like that, you know, in New York, if you're having a meal with friends, everybody puts their phone in the center of the table. And if somebody looks at their phone for the duration of the 2-hour meal, say, that person has to pay for the whole
bill.
Meal.
To pay the bill.
Well, so they should do that with musicians in the session.
Yeah.
You have to pay for the recording session if you look at your phone.
Or do it for free. But it's funny, actually, because with social media, with technology. So, which brings me back to the Side 4 Collective. Would it have been possible to do that project during the analog days, in terms of, you know, everything would have been on tape? And I was kind of thinking,
yeah,
of, because I, you
it
know,
would have, it would have, but it would have been, it would have had to have been social interaction. You would have had to have sort of had days where you invited people into the studio and say, I'm going to play these grooves, and you just have to come up with stuff off the top of your head.
Yeah.
Like, I remember doing a gig with friends of mine. I was in a band with many, many years ago in the old rock garden, and we did a gig with no songs. We had to invent our set. So we played 8 songs on the night, and every single one of them was made up on the night. And we called it the Orange Peel Sessions.
Right.
And it was a one-off, and we never did it before or after, and we were shit scared. But we did it. And we just, like, one of us would start something and then we'd make a song out of it, and the singer was making up rubbishy lyrics and kind of going into a chorus and nodding chord changes, and everybody's staring at each other, and it was frightening. It was absolutely frightening, but it was so good to do because it was releasing as well.
Yeah.
It just meant then, for example, when I was with the Frames later, when we used to improvise a lot on stage, a lot of kind of jazz excursions and left turns, I was ready for it, and I was on it. You know, I was able to improvise, and that gig really helped me to be brave enough to trust myself that I could do it.
Yeah.
But it was a really scary kind of schooling, you know?
Yeah.
But I recommend something like that to anybody. But you're asking, could the Side 4 project idea work in analog times? Yeah, I think it just would have to be where you would invite people into the studio of a week and they would come in and just go nuts. They'd just come in and improvise over the drum beat.
Sure. But I mean, in terms of, like, you know, you wouldn't have had the ability to edit as easy as you can with digital, you know, splicing the tape. But the expense of hiring a studio... 20 odd years ago. You know, you can imagine, whereas digitally, the obviously, you know, with access to digital technology, I mean, more people are putting out more and more stuff, which questions the quality of some of it as well. You know,
yes, and also the question of the spirit of editing. You know, that's a podcast in itself. Mm-hmm. Like, are we pruning music to death? Is there anything that really lights up your ears on the radio these days? I mean, I don't want to be old and cynical and say that music has gone bad and all the mavericks of the 70s and all the great times, they're gone. Like, you can't say that because there's such brilliant genius in music all the time. But I feel like we are always editing ourselves, you know? And that's true of social media as well. You'll put up their best photo of yourself. You'll put up, you're liking people. You want people to like you. It's endless kind of self-PR, you know? Yeah. And musically, we're doing the same thing. We are putting together music. Maybe originally in the rehearsal room, there's a lovely, raw, natural exuberance to it. We get it into the studio. We prune it to death. We're just clipping all the rose hedges and we're shearing all the hedges and cutting our lawns, and there's nothing left to what's left out to pasture. Or something. Yeah. So there's no parts of the garden that are wild or anything like that. It's all pruned, edited.
Yeah.
All our drumming, we can become obsessed about the drums always being spot on, in time, and then all the other instruments have to be in tune, on time, and all the vocals have to be very tuned, or whatever it's called, auto-tuned. And the gigs are becoming like that as well.
Well, everything's on backing track now. Yeah. Everybody's playing to click. Funnily enough, John Murray, who I mentioned earlier, when I did his album in Rockfield, I think we might have used a click on one song. And there was no clicks for anything really. We might have had one at the start of the song just to give the tempo. But it was massively liberating to not have to use clicks and just...
Who came up with the click anyway?
I know.
What year was it?
God knows. Well, I remember, actually, funny enough, I was watching some Live Aid recently because it was obviously the 30th anniversary, or 35th.
Yeah.
And I was watching U2 doing Bad, and they were using tracks back then.
Yeah.
In 85.
So it's going back to late 70s,
but that
really
could be like... They could have been on reels, for all I know.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah, so... I played a lot to click over the years.
But what drummer used a click track? Well, who was the first drummer to use a click track in the studio? I'd love to know.
God.
Answers on a postcard.
Yeah. You'd wonder, because I remember listening to, I think it was like a Jeff Porcaro. I think you can listen to some of his drum tracks soloed, like Rosanna, and it's just track on its own. So isolated track. But I think it's a track to like Billie Jean or Beat It or one of those.
Yeah.
And again, it's analog.
Yeah.
There's no fixing. It's just one track from start to finish, and it just sounds perfect. You know, it's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, just keep going back to this session yesterday I was doing. I was listening to me playing in rehearsal. Well, it was all of us, really. I can't take responsibility of the tempo changing. But I was noticing that I was tap-tempoing it, and it went from 70 BPM to 74 from the start of the song to the end of the song.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty big jump, you know, for someone of my... you know, experience, I suppose, is that I allow that to happen, that jump in tempo happened.
Mm.
And in the studio, we did everything to click so that wouldn't have happened. But maybe that natural exuberance and that movement that the music has to go through from the beginning to the end, maybe it needs that. Maybe it should have sped up. Maybe it's natural for it to speed up.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the way the musicians feel, and everybody was feeling the same way at the same time. It sounded great in rehearsal.
Yeah.
So is that wrong?
Well, I think you're all playing instinctively.
Was I bad, Johnny?
No, I don't think so. Jesus, I saw Ben Folds 5 in the Red Box in Dublin, like years ago, 98 maybe, 99. And I mean, they just played with the time. Like, they would go into a chorus
on
and the drummer would 10 BPMs faster, just fly ahead, just giving it the intensity.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing.
And then drop back.
And really noticeable. Really, and then pull it back. And Glenn loves doing that with the frames.
Yes.
Glenn would have you slow down going into a chorus.
That's right.
He might have you speeding up. And I love that playing with time.
Yeah.
Because
classical music would have been like that through the ages, you know?
Yeah.
So why are we starting to put these meters and exactitudes? Is it right to do it?
Well, I don't know, because funnily enough, like watching you play with someone like Paul Brady, or both of us having played with Glenn, you know, as a drummer, generally you're laying down the time. But I find if you're playing with those guys, they're laying down the time. Yeah. And you're following them. So you're almost, you know, you're like with those guys, you're watching their arm. You're watching their strum. You're actually watching their whole body.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, I remember saying to Graham,
don't watch their foot.
Yeah, but this is the thing with Graham. I says, Graham, is there any advice you can give me about playing with Glenn? And he goes, watch his foot. Because when he goes for that overdrive pedal, you know the song's coming back in. And it was a great bit of advice. Because, you know, from playing with the lads, like, they bring a song down to, from a whisper to...
It's great.
To, yeah. Like, you know, dynamite going off.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that was always the cue. Because you would just... instinctively have to follow Glenn. And I did miss a cue one time in the Olympia, and I don't think I was in the band that long, and I just remember he turned around, threw his arms up in the air, and I was so embarrassed. It was like, you know what I mean, it's like I missed a penno, you know what I mean? So, but it was only that one time, and it does, as you say, you know, about jamming or just having to jam or go off on tangents and come back and know instinctively where to go. Like, yeah. I would have learned a lot from playing with the guys. About
yes,
that.
I'd say.
You know,
yeah,
there's a lot of watching, listening on the edge of your seat.
Brilliant. Great for the audience as well.
Great for the audience, and you're being challenged.
On the edge.
And you've got, you know, when you see a bunch of guys all watching each other like a hawk, yeah. you know that's not rehearsed.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But
it can be thrilling.
So I suppose, what I wanted to ask you was just about some of the people that played on this record. You know, I know Clapton, Eric Clapton and Pete Townsend were maybes at one point.
Well, I mean, you're looking through your contacts and you're looking sometimes through your friends' contacts. And I remember that my sister goes over to visit her friend in Antigua and that Pete Townsend has a place. I'm not sure if Eric Clapton maybe as well. They've got places in Antigua, you know. And I know they hang out together. There's a bit of a gang. So my sister goes over twice a year, I think, and I said, listen, you wouldn't mind bringing over a USB stick and a little bit of a letter to each of those dudes and just see if they respond. You never know. I had low hopes. I wasn't expecting anything. So Gina said, yeah, she flew over. She met them at a party. Oh, sorry, she met Pete at a party. And I think she gave a friend the other one to give to Eric Clapton. So anyway, I wrote to Pete Townsend and he said, did you get the memory stick? And he wrote back and said, yes, it's not really my thing the way you've described it. And also just signing off here, I noticed that the letter that you sent said, Dear Eric. So I'm presuming that's Eric Clapton, and I have a funny feeling that maybe he has mine and I have his.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So I was sitting there going, wow, Pete Townsend has emailed me for a start. I felt chuffed, but he doesn't seem that interested. So I didn't write the sort of the PR letter thing. So I decided to rewrite back to him and saying, listen, this project is all about anarchy. It's about just throwing paint at a white canvas and being really experimental and having the spirit of punk, you know. And then he wrote back to me and said, why didn't you say that the first time? He said, I love the sound of this.
Yeah.
You know, and then I thought, oh, this is really great, you know. So I said, well, listen, I'll invite you to the folder of drum beats. If you have time, do something. And he said he would. And then he said, not only that, but he had helped me with the writing of the PR, you know. So he started coming up with these lines on how to sell the whole side four thing.
Right.
And I thought, how great of him to give his time to sort of, because it was very important for him to see that a wildcard project like this was presented properly with the right words. So I never got back to him to see if he did anything, but I do intend to send him a record. It mightn't have been Eric's thing. We'll never know.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, for this, like, the first record is out. The second one has kicked off again. And I've invited people like Brian Eno and someone who I met a couple of times through playing with Brona Gallagher.
Yeah.
And
Father Eno, as he's known in Father Ted.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Have you not seen this cameo on Father Ted?
No.
We're making introductions. This is Father, Father such and such. And then just for a brief second, I'm Father Eno, and he's there in the priest's outfit.
Really? Yeah, just for...
He's a nice guy. He's
That's
a nice
so
guy.
Funny. Well, listen, I am a name dropping and I don't make any excuses, but one of my favorite moments was meeting him after a gig a Brona gig in the Lexington in London. And he came up to me and he said, I really enjoyed your drumming tonight. And I was already pissing me knickers. I was so chuffed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm never starstruck with people, but for some reason, someone like him, a kind of a quiet maverick who is a very unusual approach. And I don't know, I just think the world of him.
Yeah.
And he said, and I thought he was going to talk about my drumming technically, generally, or my approach to drumming. And he said, there was a moment when you hit the cymbal and the sound of the stick hitting the cymbal was beautiful. I was just, it stuck with me and I loved it. It was just that single moment. And that was it.
That's amazing.
And I was there, what note? Yeah. Oh, to bottle it. I didn't know what he was talking about. I completely didn't expect him to talk about a single way that I hit the cymbal. But it was so typically him. He's such a boffin, I suppose. He'd be very micro about things. Is that the right way? Maybe certain personalities are. Ooh. They look for the tiny little minute detail.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily always looking at the bigger picture, you know.
Ooh.
But they're looking for a tiny little thing that might inspire them, a little sonic, you know.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be a load of big, loud, mad fills or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's good. It was a good lesson to me as well, you know.
Yeah.
Think about your sound.
That was something that only kind of came to me later on, you know. I just kind of, you had one kit, you know, in your 20s.
Yeah.
And gradually, through selling stuff and picking up other stuff and just trying things out in the studio, you start to compile your go-to gear. It's taken me a very, very long time.
And now we've too much.
Well, I've sold a lot of stuff off.
Oh,
you know,
good man.
I have sold a lot of stuff, but you know,
I'm a hoarder.
But I've got some nice gear and I'm happy with what I've got now. I don't think I need any more stuff. You know, not really. I don't know. Maybe. Give it a few
more
years.
You're not convincing me, Johnny.
The older I get, I'm like, I just want one snare, one set of cymbals, a four-piece kit. And you know what I mean? I think the older I get, I will just
decomplicate.
Declutter. Get rid of, I do find the older you get, the less. I'm not a big stuff guy. I don't like having lots of stuff even though this room I know is fairly cluttered. But, yeah, you know, I used to love buying DVDs. I used to love buying CDs. I don't need to do that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I should effectively be buying CDs instead of having Apple Music on my phone.
Yeah.
You know, I should be supporting bands. And actually, that brings us back to the whole thing of buying music. And there are people like Luca Bloom, I know who you've played with.
Yeah.
Luca came out and wrote an article, an open letter last week. And he was kind of suggesting that, look, my record's not going on Spotify or any of these streaming platforms. If you want to support me, come to my website and buy my CD.
Oh, wow.
Because that's the only way I can survive. And this is the whole thing of where I think music well, this is something I said to Nate Wood, you know, you've an obligation or to support music. And he goes, well, you're not obliged to support music, really.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think that there has to be an element of loyalty.
You mean the public are obliged to support
well,
music?
Well, yeah, you know, yeah. In Ireland you always hear that, support Irish music. But it's not your... You know, it's not your job to go and support everybody.
Yeah.
You know, somebody might be into, you know, bebop jazz. There's not a lot of that around, you know, or they might be into kind of more world music based stuff. And there's not as much of that around as we'd like. But I suppose what I would like to see happening is that loyalty to bands where, you know, people need to realize if you like these people, like you listen to them on Spotify, that's not helping them really.
Yeah.
You know, you buying a record and spending the tenner. Or buying the T-shirt, or buying a mug. This is why.
Do you have Spotify? Do you listen to Spotify?
I have Apple Music, and I bowed down to it eventually. I don't have Spotify. I don't like Spotify. Mm. I had an. I remember I was a.
That's great, Johnny. I mean, I have it and I use it, and I'm just taking music for free. You know.
Well, the thing is, you could deny your music being on Spotify and say I'm not putting it up there. But what stops anybody else going? Well, here's my playlist, and I stuck up Side 4 Collective, and so you've no control over that, so somebody else can put your music up there.
Yeah.
So I think it really stems back to kind of there has to be some kind of ownership of intellectual property.
Yeah.
And I don't think people have a responsibility. They're not obliged to do anything, but I think if you do like a band and if you want them to make another record, well, buy their present record.
Yes.
Because if you don't, it is going to get harder and harder for people. But everything's being devalued. Art is being devalued. I mean, you're a photographer. Look at how many people can take great photographs on phones now.
Yes.
My wife is great on the phone. She takes brilliant photographs. I'm brutal.
Yeah.
I used to love black and white photography. I had a lovely Yashica manual camera.
Oh, yeah.
I got mad into it, but I don't have the eye she has. And I don't know whether that's a... I mean, I'm moving on to your photography, whether can you train somebody to have an eye, or is it just something they embody where they can kind of capture that moment?
Hmm. Well, the passion and the love is first and foremost, you know. And so there's so many different types of photography that you're bound to be good at one or the other, you know. You don't have to have a specific type of mind or be particularly creative, I don't think, you know. You can get into all sorts. There's so many different styles. But I definitely got a few tips at the beginning that really helped me, you know. And it was just to do with light, really, and it was to do with timing. You know, talk about drumming and timing, you know, it's so important in photography. And, you know, Cartier-Bresson is one of my favorite photographers. And actually, he took a photograph of my grandfather in Ireland in the 1950s. And I was only browsing through a book in Canada of his, a new collection. And I opened it up in the bookshop. And there was a picture of my granddad. I nearly fell over. My favorite photographer, probably the most famous photographer in the world, had taken a picture of my granddad. And I didn't know. And none of us in the family knew, you know. He was at the front of a sort of a kneeling down outdoor mass. It was such a thrill. And I let out a big shout in the bookshop, you know. And the person that ran the bookshop came over and said, "What's going on?" And there was a big buzz of excitement between the two of us, you know. It was great.
Sorry for cutting across you. Most of your photography is black and white. Would I be right in saying that?
Yeah.
Are you familiar with John Minahan?
No.
John Minahan would have taken those kind of iconic shots of Samuel Beckett in the Parisian cafes.
Oh, beautiful,
There's a great photo he took.
Yeah, well, then I must know, So he's an Irish photographer?
Irish, but he was based in England for a long time. He lives in West Cork now. I'm hoping to interview him, actually, because I'm a huge fan of his work.
Yeah.
And again, black and white film, you know, funnily enough, I do have one of his works here, of Jimmy White. Sorry. I'm Jimi Hendrix at the Isle of Wight Festival. Not Jimmy White, the snooker player.
At the Hendrix Festival. Yeah.
But actually a friend of mine gave me a portrait that he took of me like about 8 years ago. But it's in colour. So for a guy that only shoots in black and white, I have a portrait which is in colour, which I think is kind of unique to some degree. But I've seen a lot of your work, and I know a lot of it's based around kind of concerts and musicians and things like that. And, you know, I mean, you've done some great stuff, but you've had exhibitions as well.
Yeah, but the street stuff I love as well as the music stuff, because, I mean, and I went back to this tip I was talking about that I got from Cartier-Bresson, which was what he used to do back in the days in the 50s is ramble around everywhere around Europe, the whole world. And he used to find a place, say in Paris, for example, that had a beautiful symmetry and structure. Symmetry is very important in photography, a balance of symmetry. So that's what you're looking for with your eye. And then he used to wait for his subject, maybe hours sometimes, to walk into that perfectly balanced, symmetrical picture, you know.
Yeah.
But he wanted for it to have life as well. It wasn't good enough just to have a row of trees on a boulevard with, you know, something like that with beautiful texture and environment. He wanted to have life in it as well. So something to bring it to life. So he used to wait and wait and walk up and down like a nutcase, the same road 15 times, waiting for the right person, cyclist, you know, kid, whatever it was, you know, just to be able to take that picture. But I found that the atmosphere around taking photographs changed a lot post 9/11. I was really getting into photography then, and I was stopped around 3 or 4 times on the road while I was touring with both The Frames and Josh Ritter. Mm. I was stopped by security personnel, especially in the UK, particularly paranoid, because they were wondering why I was behaving so strangely and why I was hanging around so much. And it was with the camera, whether I was trying to plant a bomb or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was extreme paranoia post 9/11 with regard to that. And the other thing was photographing kids, for example, publicly. You know, you just... In those days, in Cartier-Bresson times, you wouldn't even think twice about it. Mm. If a kid was... There's a famous photograph with a kid coming through a tunnel in a street with a French baguette or something, and it's an astonishingly beautiful photograph. But these days, if you took a picture of a kid with a baguette walking along the street in Paris, people would be looking at you sideways going, "What are you doing?
Yeah.
And if you were the parent of that kid, you'd be going, what are you doing, you know?
Yeah.
So there's this new sort of consciousness that you have to be wary of and careful of, whether you're sort of breaching security measures by the post 9/11 paranoia, or whether you're taking a picture of something which you can't be or you shouldn't
be. It's not consensual, I suppose, if it's a child or...
That's the thing, you know, this is a new thing that wasn't around in those days for those photographers. They didn't even have to worry or think about it, you know, but we have to think about these things, and maybe it's fair enough, but it's all part of the new culture and the new analysis of what we do and how we behave. And I know some people have ruined it for us, you know. But I even remember being in the frames with Cullen McInerney. He was in the band, and we were on the border in Mexico coming back across into the States. And there was this person who's a junkie and really washed out in bad shape, coming over towards the car and almost like a zombie. And I'd lifted up my camera, and being the novice beginner, I wanted to be like a photojournalist and take a picture of this person who was kind of coming towards the car. Mm. And Cullen said, don't do that. That's not right, because that person is suffering and you're taking a picture.
So he saw it as exploitative, maybe.
He did, yeah. And I disagreed with him, and we had this kind of toing and froing a little bit in the car talking about it. And I said that I felt like it's important to bring these kind of political things to the fore and bring them out publicly. You know, as long as you're relatively sensitive about it and you have the right caption,
yeah,
and you're genuinely trying to help the situation. But he genuinely, I don't know how he would feel now, because I know he's into photography himself, but we disagreed. And there was another time when I was in New York and I was passing by a restaurant window, and there was two people fine dining in the restaurant, and there was a down and out wino in front of them on the outside of the restaurant, completely in a heap, you know, on the park bench. And I went up and I took the photo because of the juxtaposition between the people fine dining and the person,
yeah,
who was in bits in front of them. And I thought, this is going to be a great photograph. It's a story in itself, you know, it highlights the contrast. Mm. And so I took the picture. And this woman came up to me, a small Jewish woman, and she came up and she absolutely berated me. She said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm taking a photograph. And she said, that is a disgusting thing to do. That poor person is suffering. And would you not think of going over and helping them instead of taking a photograph of them?
Yeah.
What are you going to do with the photograph? How's that going to help you? Is this for supposedly artistic reasons? Are you getting a kick out of this? The fact that he's suffering like that? This has been read the riot act. And I felt terrible for the rest of the day, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just like, you know, there's a real moral dilemma sometimes with photography for all that myriad of reasons I just described. So it's just something that you have to be mindful of, you know. But in the end, it's still a great way to be creative and to express yourself. I adore
it. Well, as you say, the point you're trying to make is that juxtaposition of the rich and the poor, you know, where you've got, as you say, the people fine dining. I mean, it kind of just off the top of my head reminds me of that photograph, you know, of the Vietnam War, where that child is about 5 years of age standing in the street naked.
For example, yeah.
And all that carnage is going on around. And the child's crying.
Yeah.
You know, and then
there's another one for Vietnam. You were going to say.
The guy shooting the bullet into the guy's head. There was a guy called Tim Page. I don't know if you know Tim Page. Tim Page was a pretty well-known journalist in the Vietnam War. I read his book a long time ago when I was a teenager.
No.
But yeah, I suppose attitudes do change.
So was it right to take those photographs? Of those Vietnamese people.
Well, you see, I mean, you look at, that's a very iconic photograph, and it depicts the brutality of war, you know, and then that's all, I suppose, and again, a different time. And funny you mentioned Cullen as well, because what I remember from Cullen is, you know, sometimes you'd park a tour bus up and Cullen was always giving money to poverty-stricken people on the streets. And
lovely kindness.
Yeah, he was always kind of doing that. Or, you know, I remember being up in Billings, Montana, and there's nothing there. And you've got all these old Indians, you know, guys just on the street, and you can see their weather-beaten faces from alcoholism. And, you know, he'd be going out and he'd be, do you want a cigarette? And kind of just chatting to them, really. I think he was kind of keen to, you know, get to know them and just kind of see where they're at to some degree. You know, I displayed a lot of empathy as far as I could see.
But it was good to have his point, because it balanced my approach going forward. So it didn't necessarily stop me, you know, but it made me think about it, you know, every aspect of it.
Yeah.
And that's what we all should do.
Well, absolutely. And you know, it's I think it's fine to have an opinion. And funnily enough, going back to social media, this is where I just detest Facebook. I've just learned to detest it because I keep having to delete stuff I put up there because I keep not necessarily like...
Getting hate mail.
Well, you know, obviously the Black Lives Matter and there's different opinions on comedy and things like that. And, you know, now, you know, as one comedian said 10 years ago, the line was here. Now the line was here. And I'm being berated for something I said 10 or 15 years ago because political correctness has changed towards those
That's
views.
That's a great point.
You know, and it's like, well, what I said, I meant it 10 years ago. I may not mean it now, but you can't, you know, hold me up against those comments.
No.
But the thing about Facebook is, and somebody pointed this out, right? If you get into a debate with somebody, which I've had debates with people over Spotify, songwriters going, well, it gets my music out there. Does it pay your fucking rent? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've had 50,000 hits on Spotify. Really, go book Vicar Street. Let's see how many tickets you sell. Because those hits on Spotify aren't going to put bums on seats.
No.
You know, I don't think so. You know, but maybe I could be wrong because look, I'm from a different generation and I've different views on things and I do value music higher. But yeah, but a valid point someone said to me, no matter how much you get into a debate on Facebook, you'll never change anybody's mind. All you're doing is making yourself anxious, get agitated with people.
Yeah.
And some comments then can come across, you know, I've had to do things where send private messages. Are we cool? Because, you know, I just,
yeah,
you know, I
hard try to pick up the tone.
Well, I tried to make a point about Fawlty Towers, okay, where the N-word is used, okay? And of course, everybody jumped in this bandwagon. And the thing about it is, when someone's 20 years of age and they're lecturing me, it's like, did you watch the episode?
Yeah.
Do you understand the satirical element, which is basically John Cleese is not taking the piss out of black people, nor is he taking the piss out of the Germans, which is the particular episode. He's taking the piss out of the English and their views on other cultures.
Yeah.
That's why it's funny. And of course, I was trying to make this point. And, you know, yeah, well, systematic racism and stuff. You know, I've no problem with anyone. I mean, we're well travelled to a large degree. I've experienced nothing but kindness from people from different cultures all over the world. I'm comfortable with how I feel about other people and races. I'm, you know, but I suppose the point I was trying to make and getting into these debates with people, John Cleese went online and made the exact same point I made. And what he just said is, if you don't get the gag, it's because you're stupid. But look, and again, I get myself into trouble. And what happens is I have these threads of, and I'm thinking, will I reply to this? And what I do is I just delete the whole thread.
Right.
Nobody comes back to you the next day and go, what happened to that conversation we were having online?
So they've moved on already.
They've moved on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, because again, people are at home and they're focusing in on different things. And my argument is that a lot of you out there just jumping on a bandwagon and an ideal. Where were you 10 years ago with that? Where were you, you know, like, you know, it's just, and this is the whole thing about bandwagon jumpers. I don't want
to. People are very righteous, I find, these days, you know.
Yeah.
Very slow to be empathetic or have a look at other people's viewpoint or try to understand it. Very quick just to jump at people and to sort of bash them with their digital remote stick, you know. Effectively, they're just, it's lacking courage. I just like having those conversations in the pub or at the bus stop. Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
They're not the kind of conversations people should be having online because you genuinely get upset. People get upset.
Is there any argument for it? I mean, do you ever feel educated or feel like that was a great debate discussion that I just had with somebody online on a social platform?
I haven't had one. I haven't had one. And maybe
Jesus.
Well, I think as well as when you do get older, like, you know, the opinion of me at 46 compared to someone who's 20 years of age.
Yeah.
Like, they, you know, they haven't led the life I've led. But I don't want to be lectured by someone who has very little life experience, who's living at home with their parents.
Mm.
Maybe doesn't even have a job. You know, it's like
if it's lecturing they're doing, then no, you don't.
Yeah, I got a bit of that. But you know, let them have their say, let them have, and I respect their opinion, but they're not going to change mine.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not, and that's the way it is. And I think that's why Facebook is poisonous, because all these people are having all these arguments that get you nowhere.
Mm.
Don't get you anywhere. They just get you agitated. And I actually think as a platform, it's because, and particularly when Trump got into power, it just became this poisonous, you know, people are projecting a lot of their hate.
I believe he's trying to buy TikTok or something like that.
Sorry, yeah, so
move
so,
off the point, but that's, again, that's dangerous in itself.
Look, peace and love all the way. I'm not there to agitate people, and you know, and to be honest, I think the point I was trying to make was people on this can be assholes, on Facebook can be assholes. I've been an asshole. I'm the first guy to put my hand up and go, I'm an asshole, and I'm sorry about that. And if I don't want to offend anybody,
can I ask you something about Irish people and social platforms? Do you think that it suits us? Because I've heard many people, including a Dutch friend of mine, for example, who said that Irish people don't always say what they mean. They don't always speak their mind. They're not clear enough in what they actually are thinking, you know, and they hide behind their feelings, and they kind of sometimes just agree to be seen as being agreeable socially. And there's a little bit of lack of courage, and like a Dutch person is obviously is extreme, because I'm generalizing now with Irish people and Dutch people, but Dutch people will say exactly what's on their mind.
French are like
quite
that.
Cutting. Yeah.
My marriage one does.
Right, yeah.
You're married. I know the crack.
Yeah, so, you know, and they'll argue it saves time. You know, it's honest, it's direct, and, you know, and sort of, whereas the Irish people have this kind of sense of, and then maybe that's why we're loved all over the world, you know, because we don't like to sort of upset people necessarily, and we're kind of like thinking a little bit more about how we're going to approach the social situation. But is this social platforming an extension of that, of being a little bit hidden, a little bit not exactly being exposed and being honest and being courageous? Because you can hide in social media, you know, and there's a little bit of dishonesty. I'm sorry, it doesn't, and it's just occurred to me that there might be a link there, and that it might really suit us socially to have this guard. It's like it's a shield, it's a guard, and yeah, we're hiding behind it.
Well, I was getting upset at the thought that I might be upsetting somebody else. I might be upsetting a 20 or 25 year old guy or a girl who, they have their values.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to force my opinion on them.
Yeah.
But the minute you put stuff on Facebook, well, then it's out there. And I was hurt, because I was like, well, I think that person's a nice person, regardless of what their views are.
Yeah.
And I don't really want to get them riled up, particularly in the times we're living in.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be ramming my opinion down their throat. But at the same time, I don't want to be lectured either. So it's that thing of, I actually just made a decision where I even post stuff and I just take it down. I'm like, I walk away from my phone and go, what did you post that for? And just take it down.
My point is that you had that discussion and disagreement with each other online because it was possibly easier. Would you have even had it face to face? Would it have happened with that person? I wonder.
It wouldn't. No, because these are like, they're kind of deep chats about beliefs and, you know, politics.
Yeah, but we're not willing to have it face to face. I suppose that's my point about sometimes that Irish people can sometimes be like that, you know?
Yeah.
Just hesitate to be honest and face to face in front of somebody.
Well, I had to be agreeable. And what I had to do then was I became quite defensive and passive. And I tried to just deflect the whole conversation almost into something else to kind of, are we cool? You know, hey, everything's,
Would it keep you awake at night, literally?
Thought of maybe hurting somebody's feelings or maybe just upsetting them, or, you know, you could see them getting quite passionate about their beliefs, and that's fine. And just for me, I actually feel guilty about just engaging of a conversation of that nature online. I'd happily have that conversation face to face with anybody, you know, but the point I'm trying to make is you will never change anyone's opinion on Facebook or their beliefs.
Mm.
So what happens is all these debates just fizzle out into nothing until eventually someone just doesn't get back to a response.
Yeah.
So for me, it's definitely not a platform. I actually think it's done me more harm than good, you know.
Wow.
I remember a few years ago, I just got rid of it off my phone and I was like, no, I'm not going on there for a long time.
I don't like Facebook, and I like Instagram only because it suits my photographic tendencies, and it's much more visual and it's much less political.
Yeah.
So.
But, we're seeing things like social anxiety now. This has become a new norm.
That's why I asked you about kind of staying up, thinking about these things all night. Is this social anxiety born out of social platforms? Is it?
I think to some degree, because we're not engaging as heavily in person anymore. Like kids are staying in
the room. Where you can solve it. quicker, yeah. I think.
Kids are talking on their phones now, and maybe they can see each other's face, which I think makes a difference. Mm. But yeah, I much prefer to live in the real world, even though I still post stuff on Instagram. I still have to self-promote. I still have to be visible online to some degree. But I know there's people out there, like, for example, you know, Graham. Like, anything Graham puts on social media relates to him, his drumming, or drumming in general. There's not a family picture up there, as far as I've ever seen. He might take a picture with his dad, but his dad's a drummer. And, you know, and I really think he's using it the right way.
Really?
Well, I mean, as much as it's for self-promotion, it's also he's also very passionate about drums and drummers and, you know, the people he's met over the years. And I think the fact that he sticks to just that one area, I think that's
doing himself a favour.
Yeah, because other people, like, I could have a video up of me kids, and then the next day I'm banging on about Fawlty Towers, or then I might post something that's, you know, an article in the newspaper that's about what's going on now. And but I just don't really, I'd rather play my cards close to my chest. Look, it's nice to be nice, you know what I mean? It's nice to be nice, and I just don't want to upset anybody. You know, I'd much rather do that in person. I'm pretty good at it. My mother will tell you.
I've never known you to do that.
Well, look, okay, so that was very interesting. But look, let's talk about the Frames, because but there's Josh and there's Brady and there's Brona and there's, but just, you were in the Frames for about 5 years, weren't you?
Yeah.
And you've come back to play with Glenn. As Glenn solo or the Swell season? I think you did both, did you?
I did a little bit with Swell season, and then a little bit with Glenn's solo stuff last year and this year. Yeah, little bits and bobs. And then some Frames gigs in the last couple of years, but there had been very few. They were just really sort of private, almost sort of small scale secret events or something, you know. Yeah. So they're low key gigs anyway, but great fun, just great fun to play together with the gang. And it just goes to show you, you know, water under the bridge. And myself and Glenn famously fell out back in the day, and I swore that I'd never talk to him again. And I'd never look at him again. And of course, time passes and you start to realize that what happened back then was takes two to tango, that it was just as much my fault as it was his.
Yeah.
But emotions run high, you know, and you don't see it at the time. And then we both, I think, evolved as human beings. Yeah. And I think we get on way, way better now, you know. Yeah. Maybe it was a good learning experience for him as well. You'd have to ask him. But it was a tough old falling out, you know. It scarred me a bit, and it made me question a lot of things. I mean, you know, the strange thing was that, I mean, we can talk about the breakup if you want, but after that, luckily, I went straight into a job with Josh Ritter.
Yeah.
And I was touring with Josh, and you went straight into a job with the Frames.
I did. Well, I'd finished up with Marianne Faithfull, but I had a ropey 6 months where there wasn't much going on.
All right.
And the money was running out, but I got the call, thankfully.
No, but I just remember this meeting with Josh hadn't really toured. And so the manager sat down with Josh and the band, and he said, listen, an offer has come up to tour around the States. And we were all going, oh, that's cool. Great. Let's do it. And the manager said, well, I just want to tell you who the band is with just first, just so as you know. And we were all listening. And he said, it's with the Frames. And I had just had this massive fallout, breakup, row, like disintegrating, horrible, destructive thing. And I was sitting there going, of all, like, how many bands are in the world? is there a million bands in the world? Probably.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
So one in a million. It was one of those one in a millions. And I just thought, so we're going on the road with the Frames. And they said, yeah. And you're the drummer with Josh Ritter. And you used to be the Frames. Yeah, so get over yourself kind of thing. Because we have to do this for the good of the band. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. It was tough. Like,
yeah. Well, imagine what it's like for me. Because I was only in the band about 8 months. You know, and all of a sudden, the drummer who just left the band like a year before, whatever it was, he's, you know, you were coming in. And obviously, for me, then that would have made me feel slightly insecure, as it's like, I hope Dave approves of what I'm doing or the songs. And do you know what I mean? But Because I knew there was a vibe between you and Glenn, and I'm sure at the time it was probably hard for you to come on tour, because I've been in bands where I've fallen out. Time's a great healer, and as you say, you do grow as a person, and stuff that was maybe important to you at the time becomes less important as you get older.
Yeah.
But I remember, I think Glenn was trying to make a concerted effort to just engage with you. And we were sound checking one day, and I think you were just like walking around the venue, and you were just down the back of the room, and Glenn's on the mic, Dave, and you kind of stopped, and I think you had your camera with you or whatever, and he just, Dave, just, there's a great camera shop around the corner, right? Yeah, you know, because obviously him being an avid photographer as well, and you know, it's great. And I remember you looked at him for about 5 seconds, and I just thought, I had enough time to go, he's just going to tell him to go fuck himself. Right? And I think you just paused for a minute, and you looked and went, all right, yeah. You just walked off. You know, but actually, the tour actually went quite well, and it was grand. It was grand in the end. You know what I mean? I think.
And the healing had begun.
I think, was that not the tour where, that we were in the Scratcher one night, and there was some jock, big jock there, you know, and he was just being a bit rowdy, and he was being really rude to a girl that was in our company,
right?
You know, and Glenn was having none of it, you know. I think, you know, Glenn was like, dude, you better fucking, you know, get the fuck out of here, you're being such a dick, you know, and the guy was all getting shirty. And I remember, actually, I vividly remember, because Cullum was outside having a smoke, he's having a smoke. If Sheila hears he was smoking a fag, she'd kill him. But I just remember Glenn let this guy have it in the nuts, you know, and that was it. Game over for him. And I'll tell you, he was twice the size of Glenn. He was fucking built like a brick shit house. But that just ended your man's night. He was being a dick and he deserved it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? He deserved it. But sorry, I know you were on that tour and you left the band, but you know, you were there for 5 years and a couple of records, and Set Lists was a big record for the band.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I loved it. I loved the time because, you know, traveling and, yeah, getting into the photography and hanging out with musicians who genuinely loved to improvise on stage, and the gigs were thrilling, you know? I mean, we were four to a room in motels, you know, and it was pretty rough, you know, yourself. Like, everybody talks about the weird five-way marriage that being in a band can be, especially when you're on the road, because every minute you're together, you're going to the toilet together, you're eating together, you're traveling in the same bus together, you're sleeping in the same bed together. So literally every second of the day, you're with each other, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm quite claustrophobic by nature. So therefore, I used to disappear famously. And you've probably heard the stories where I would just go AWOL, like with my camera, I would just go. And I'd turn up after sound check or something, and they'd be like, Dave, where were you? Like, you can't just turn up now. After rambling around the city, because I mean, you're not on holidays, you're on the road, and it was wrong of me, you know. I shouldn't have done that, and I can only see it now, and I wouldn't do it now, you know, as much. And I definitely learned that lesson, and it was a little bit selfish, you know, and it was partly born out of claustrophobia, but it was also a little bit towards the end, the last year, and this is not getting on with Glenn, and I just found myself every time he walked into a room that I'd walk out of it, and that wasn't fair on the rest of the band. It was, honestly, truly was not fair, and the way I behaved was out of order, you know. And I only see it now.
Yeah, but we all know what it's like. I've seen other people on the road who just, well, you know, I'm not saying you weren't enjoying it, but let's, you know, I've been on the road where there's been tenuous relationships that they just reach boiling point and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, I saw it with Picture House with Duncan. You know, Duncan just didn't want to be on tour with us anymore, and I get it.
Yeah.
And again, you know, we four guys pulling in one direction, and he just wasn't, I don't think, as invested. And it's actually okay. But at the time, you're so invested, and nobody's getting paid, and you're living in a van, and you're living in shitty rooms. And that's the other side of it as well, is you're really working hard for, and you're coming home then and you're broke.
Well, I was in the situation where I suppose I didn't really want to be there anymore. I didn't want to be in the band, and I didn't like the way there was a kind of a lack of democracy, let's say, you know, and I was being righteous about that. And I was always on my high horse about it. Why isn't everything fair? Why isn't everything equal? And it just wasn't, you know. Glenn was the leader of the band, and I could never really accept that, you know. It definitely was tough to get my head around.
Yeah.
But you know, it's just, yeah, again, time is a good healer, and eventually we got to get on, you know, we get on now well, really, really well. But it was tough at the time.
Yeah, I can imagine. It was same for me when I had to leave Picture House, you know. It was time to go.
Yeah, my point would have been like, when you don't want to be in a band, you shouldn't be there. And I've been in bands since, and I'm in a band at the moment, where I have the feeling that the people don't really want to be in the band.
Ooh.
And if you don't want to be in the band, don't be in the band.
Yeah.
You know, I don't be institutionalized by it. Don't be afraid to leave it.
Yeah.
Go, leave, you know. And it's very harsh for me to say that, you know.
Yeah.
And but it's living with me, you know, and I was that person. And I think you owe it to everybody not to be hanging around and making a bit of a downer. And you're talking about the energy that you put into a band should be somewhat equal, you know.
Yeah.
And if it's not, then just move on, move away, move on.
Yeah. I mean, I always felt like, you know, the touring's great in your 20s, and you're just, I had no responsibilities really until in my later 20s when I had kids and stuff like that. But but I certainly, how would you say? Well, as we used to say in Picture House, rip the hole out of it. We had a good time, you know, I had a good time, because it's, you know, and it's that thing when you're away, like all you got to think about every day is just that 2 hours you're on stage for, you know. Yeah. It's different when you're at home and you're dealing with day to day life.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're out gigging, and then you're coming home and there's dishes in the sink and there's kids that need to be brought to school, and you're, you know, it's a different kind of thing. And it's a real luxury to be on the road. And actually, you know, following in your footsteps and previous drummers and Pinzer and Graham, and, you know, and obviously the Frames, highly respected band in Ireland and now around the world. And they were tough shoes to fill. But it was that thing of, like, you get an opportunity to play with guys that are really good,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to up your game. And that's kind of, you know, where I was at with that. It was a real challenge, But you know what? There's plenty of stuff up online. I think as far as I'm happy with the job I did. Except for the gig I missed one time, which I couldn't do, you know, I was very disappointed in myself, you know. I wasn't feeling well, because there was one time, and actually I think it was around this time, it was in August, and I was due to get married, and I was just trying to organise my wedding, stressed out, and I went out with Joe the night before the show, and we had a few jars, but I don't recall, like, drinking loads.
Mm-hmm.
But I just got the next day and I was so ill and I couldn't do the gig. I was like, lads, like, I can't. And it was like 34 degrees out, festival outside on in the middle of the day. So I was just curled up in a ball listening to the lads playing. And Glenn got some dude out of the audience who got up for the last two songs and played drums. But I was really disgusted with myself. I was really disappointed, because I always enjoyed myself on tour, but I could always do the gig.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that thing of, like, when you hear, like, your guys old Dean, or, you know, the famous Adam Clayton story where he just woke up 3 days later in a hotel room and he missed the show and his bass tech did the gig. And, you know, those kind of things can happen. And I think sometimes you can get a little bit lost in yourself. I mean, that's where, let's face it, that's where a lot of musicians get into drugs and stuff like that, because every night you sweat so much and you're energized and your adrenaline's up after a show, and you can pound and drinks back, and guys get into all sorts of drugs and stuff
it's just,
you know,
one long party, yeah, and you're trying to keep up with it.
Yeah, I mean,
fluctuating moods and the highs and the lows, and, like, I'm not. It's you know what? It's a privilege. It really is.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It's you have to be careful, because you could definitely go down the addiction route.
Yeah, I've never mixed any of that with playing or anything like that. I have a few beers after a show or whatever. I've never drank before a gig. I can't do it. I just fall apart. But for me, it's all about the gig. Then after whatever happens, happens.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, I was challenged for those 4 years. I was deeply disappointed. I mean, I was delighted.
Do you think that it's still an unhealthy environment? Like, you know, would you dissuade your kids from becoming a rock and roller? Is there too many extremes if you're a vulnerable personality or a sensitive personality, which you probably are if you're a musician? Is there something that you'd have to be careful about recommending?
I think you need to be strong to some degree. You know, you do have to be strong personality-wise. I think physically as well, the physicality of touring and sleeping on tour buses, and sometimes it's luxurious, sometimes it's not. Yeah. I was very lucky because when I joined the Frames, we did a six-week tour with Damien Rice, and that upped their profile in America. So all of a sudden they were able to get a tour bus in the States.
Right.
And around Europe we'd go on a tour bus. And so I did catch them at a time when they're on a bit of a crest of a wave. And then obviously, you know, doing Marley Park and the three arena. And so
you're not allowed to do number twos on tour buses, by the way.
Drawback. No, that's the big no-no.
And if you've had a good few drinks the night before or a Vindaloo, it's not going to end well.
Stay away from the curries.
You hear the stories of plastic bags being filled and thrown out the window.
but like I say, I know you were, George, as you say, you made some great points. And I when you were there and what can kind of happen personality wise and how you feel about things. And I was actually just hired as a session guy, really. That's weird as well. When you're in a band and there's four guys, they're the band and you're the session guy. That's kind of weird. And I was, you know, that kind of thing. Well, we're having a meeting with the label. Can you just sit over there with the crew? And a little bit of that. But I think Glenn got to the point where he's just, just get the photographs. Just get the fucking photo. Because it was the four lads being photographed. And eventually, I'm sure he went, well, look, they've been seeing this guy behind the kit for 2 or 3 years now. Just get him in the photographs, you know?
Yeah, how do they think they were? Cheers for fears.
So, you know, but as I say, really enjoyed it. I was delighted for Glenn winning his Oscar. And I knew he's got that Oscar now. Him and Marquette are going to go touring. I knew that was inevitable.
Yeah.
So I think the last show I did was in Vicar Street 2000. It was probably New Year's Eve 2007, maybe. And I kind of knew that was that. You know, but I think I was kind of deeply disappointed because, you know, when you have a good job, it was a good job. And Claire Ledbetter, who manages Glenn in the Frames, I mean, Claire's just incredible. You know, again, just the way she'd look after you and treat you properly. And, you know, because when it came to business, getting paid, or that's who you dealt with. We never discussed any business with the band.
But she has an amazing ability to be direct. We were talking about being direct earlier. So she'll be really direct, but in a way that she just puts her arm around you and just makes you feel good about the situation. I don't know how. It's a really, really great skill to have. Yeah. I mean, I wish I had it. I don't.
It's funny because I've said this before, but sometimes I look back on that stuff and you know, it's almost like you're looking into someone else's life, you know, because you are a different person back then, you know?
Yeah.
And it's almost like some crazy, wild dream. I was only thinking this morning when I woke up, I was thinking of the Damien Rice tour. And I actually don't remember. I don't remember any of the shows. I remember Damien playing. I vaguely remember playing some of the places. I do remember flashing Shane Fitzsimons from the side of the stage one time. We played this venue, and the side where you came off stage left, there was just literally a stairs that went directly up to the shower room. So I came out and Damien's doing this quiet song. I remember just full tail open, just flashed. Nobody else saw it.
What a thrill for Shane.
So of course he's just trying to maintain some kind of, you know, trying to stop laughing, you know, because you can't be laughing when there's a real mellow part of a song, or you know. But I got him good that night. I got him good. But it's like the Josh Ritter tour. I kind of vague recollections of stuff as well. Maybe my memory's just not that good anymore. Too much partying on the road.
That's what we'll say. Yeah.
And so Paul Brady, funnily enough, I think the first time I saw you playing actually with a band, I think it was with Paul Brady. I'd seen you doing other stuff, but I don't think I'd ever seen you play fully with a band.
That's the funny thing about us as a fraternity of drummers, that we can know each other for a long, long time. And I still haven't seen certain drummer friends play because we're out gigging different gigs. So we congregate and have a cup of tea and teach together or see each other in the pub on our nights off. But sometimes it's rare to see your own peers playing.
Yeah.
So I can imagine, that probably was the first time. But Paul has a reputation for being straight talking, and also he has a reputation of being tough with people, you know?
Yeah.
And he's just well known for it. I didn't find that, you know, and maybe he's mellowed. But I certainly have always had a great time with him. But, you know, there was a couple of occasions where he is quite demanding, you know, and he gets stressed before gigs. He gets very hyper. There's kind of a hypertension and, yeah. and it's all released afterwards. And he's full of love and appreciation for everybody after the gig because he's relaxed then and it's done.
Yeah.
The pressure is over. It's but before a gig, he can get really wound up and uptight, yeah. you know. And so I remember a couple of people getting it in the neck from him. But, you know, he's such an amazing musician. And I would always look up to him. And yet it was in a respectful way, and yet I remember him, I can't remember, we didn't have a disagreement, but he said to me one day that, you know, let me lead the time. You were talking about it, like, for example, if I'm going into the chorus and I want to slow down, let me slow down. Don't try and bully the time, don't try and straighten the time, allow me to sort of fall slowly into that chorus, you know, follow me, you know. And I said, okay, that's a great tip, I'll do that. But then one night in Vicar Street, he called me aside and he said, last night's gig was okay, but I found that you're kind of, there's a couple of songs where you're kind of behind, you're behind the beat, you know. And I said, well, that's my, it's kind of my thing in certain genres, certain songs, certain tempos that I will play behind the beat. It's just my, it's a stylism, I suppose, that I have, a mm. characteristic. And that's why some people employ me and that's why some people don't employ me. So it was kind of funny that he was picking it out. And I also sort of was thinking, but you're saying that you're leading the time. So then therefore, surely I have to either be on that time or a little bit behind that time. I can't be ahead of the time, surely, if you're leading the time.
Yeah.
And I think I did say it to him, actually. And it was just one of those, we were kind of like, agree to disagree kind of on it.
Yeah.
But it's a big thing, of course. Drummers talk to drummers about timekeeping, and you know that it should be like one of those kind of areas of hypersensitivity, and there's loads of jokes, of course, about it.
Yeah.
And Robbie Malone, our friend who plays with David Gray, will always throw a slag in about drummers and timekeeping, and can you not hear the click in your headphones and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
We are hypersensitive about it. So it was just the only moment I remember with Paul where I was just felt a little bit like, how are we going to solve this, you know?
Yeah.
But we did. And it's just a great honor to play, you know, when you're playing with a legend, you know, you just have to, as you did as well, have to thank your lucky stars.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny after all of these years that he still gets wound up in the sound check. And, you know, and I think you have to kind of be forgiven for that as well.
Yeah, it's part of the process.
Well, it's a responsibility. You know, that room's going to be full of people and you want to do the best show, which, like, for him as well, he wants to make sure he can hear everything the way he wants to hear it. And because I know he kind of, his gigs are like the Grand Ole Opry, where he has this big open, is it like a Neumann mic? So,
yeah.
So, you know, obviously you have to be sensitive to that as well for spill and stuff. When I did Vicar Street with him.
Sound, yeah.
When I did, he had them put the Perspex screen around me. I was playing a fucking cajon, right, and a few shakers, right. And he had the Perspex, and then he had them take it down.
I think
right.
I remember you telling me that's your approach. I think I heard a gig actually. I was trying to figure out, is this my approach? Should I approach it this way or?
Yeah, well, he didn't want drums, so it was a very kind of stripped back thing. And it was, do you know what? It was a real privilege for me to be on that stage with him because I brought my dad and my brother. And my dad took me to see Brady when I was like maybe 10. So like around 1984 in the Olympia, you know. And I remember we snuck into a box. There was an empty box. And my dad's like, come on, let's go in here. And it was just great to kind of come full circle where I you know, 10 years of age seeing Paul Brady. I never thought 30 years later.
Yeah.
I'd be on the stage. And I know it was only cajon. I would have loved an opportunity to play kit. But I don't think my style of playing would lend itself to some of his more delicate songs, you know. And I think what you did in the gig was just fabulous, you know. But yeah, it's down to following his strum. And I actually have a recording of that Vicar Street gig. And it's fairly locked in.
Yeah.
Thank God. I'd never forgive myself if it wasn't, you know.
Yeah.
But so at the moment you're playing with Brony. You've been playing with Brony a long time.
Yeah.
Is that your kind of regular gig at the minute, or I suppose one of them?
Brona is like Ireland's Janis Joplin.
Yeah.
I think she just has such a powerful pair of lungs and such passion and such humour. I mean, I think she's the funniest person in Ireland, possibly.
Yeah.
You know, I just think she would make, she is an actress, she is a comedian, she is a great drummer, singer, everything, you know, she has got all these talents. But she could have easily gone down the road of comedy and had a great success, I think, in it.
Yeah.
But anyway, point is that she kind of splits her time still between acting and between music.
Yeah.
And I suppose I'd love it now, selfishly, if she was just doing the music, because we'd probably get a better momentum and we'd really get a good flow on, because the band always feels good and the gigs feel great. And we're doing something, I think, that's dark and sweaty and passionate and soulful that is kind of, that can be missing sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's largely due to her ability to sing so passionately, you know? I miss that. I'm always listening out for it, whether it's Spotify, sorry, or whether it's on Jules Holland, or wherever I'm listening to music on the radio. I'm listening for the raw passion, especially in the vocal,
yeah,
because it's missing. It really can be missing.
Yeah.
And I get such a kick when I hear it. Yeah, it doesn't even have to be in tune.
Yeah.
It just has to be passionate sometimes. Yeah. Well, not all the time, but there are certain deliveries, I think they need to be passionate, and you almost need to feel the singer going out of control, almost like losing themselves.
Yeah.
And there are some singers are afraid to, but Brona isn't.
No, she's fearless. She is fearless. She did a show in probably on her first album, opening up for the Frames in Vicar Street. And I was, you know, just before she went on, I went out front, you know. I'd always go out and catch the opening act or whoever was playing. And she came out and she was drumming and singing at this point. So, but she came out and she sat behind her kit. And I was like, where's the rest of the band? And she just started singing a cappella right in front of full house. And I was like, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Do you know, and it's those little things that I remember, mm-hmm. you know, just to be able to go out on your own and do that. I just thought it was fabulous. But she is a great musician, all around her. I mean, Jesus Christ.
But again, sorry to interrupt you, but we're obviously not, the government, for example, and the industry in general are not supporting these gems, these treasures, you know. Ooh. So Brona is, maybe she wants to do the acting as well. She's so brilliant at it. She's ambition for that as well, but honestly, she struggles to try to make a living for herself and all of us as well.
Yeah.
Because she's just not getting the support.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm just going through the list. The band is great. She's great. She's funny. She does great shows. She sings passionately. She writes great songs. The albums are great. What's wrong? Like, why is not this artist doing really well, or at least being supported to give them an opportunity to do really well? Why not?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, I'm just a firm believer that we're living in a kind of a, you know, a very oversaturated industry.
Mm.
I mean, look at like Netflix now. I mean, I don't know if you use Netflix, but I will spend 25 minutes just flicking before I decide what I'm going to watch. And then sometimes I go, ah, fuck it, and I just go to sleep at nighttime. You know, and it's the same with music, you know, just on my phone. I've got access to whatever I want, you know, you know, it's just oversaturation everywhere. And I suppose that my father always had a baked beans analogy, you know, when you're going down the aisle in the shopping centre and there's seven different brands of baked beans, like, you know, what's going to make you pick, which one is going to stand out? How do you make your tin of baked beans stand out from everybody else's?
Yeah.
Is it branding? You know, is it like, I mean, there's many different facets for that, but it is hard to just take it up to that next level where you can make a living. I mean, look, and at the times we're living in now, who knows? Like, you've got bands starting out, like the Fontaines, like, for example, they're on their second album already, and that's just come out. And I'm sure, I think it's going to go number one in the UK. It'll probably go number one here.
Right.
Which is great, but they can't tour it. I mean, I know they can do stuff on TV and stuff, but how are they going to be selling their merchandise or their T-shirts at a gig? Or, you know, how do you monetize, like, you know, you do see these guys, oh, you're doing great, you're on the TV, you're not making any fucking money.
Yeah.
You know, and that's ultimately what, that's where a lot of bands break up. You get to 30 years of age and you go, okay, I'll never afford a house.
Yeah.
I don't want to have kids because I could never afford it, or, you know, and it's that thing of, it is very hard to balance a personal life and that kind of life as well.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's true. And I think, yeah, I'd love to know the percentage of bands that have split up because of the COVID and the unsustainability of the band, you know. I mean, you know, I play with Keela.
Yeah.
And we have had our problems over the COVID time because of the very reason that you're talking about. You know, people are suffering from not being able to gig financially, but also their soul as well. They need to play for their soul. And so it's not just a financial thing. So they're not benefiting on either fronts, you know?
Yeah.
And that causes friction within the band then. Some people lose faith. They look for things that are already making them unhappy within the band. They start focusing on that. Old wounds, raw stuff comes up. Arguments, disrespect, stuff like that, you know? I mean, what a wonderful band of such great people. But these times are testing, you know? They are testing every single one of us individually, but also the units that we work within. Yeah. Again, whatever your work is, not saying you're in a band or anything like that, doesn't matter what you're in, assuming that you are working with people. It's testing.
It is testing. I mean, the album I did with John Murray was supposed to come out next month, and now I think it's been pushed back to January, and John is dying to play. He's like, man, let's book a gig. Let's get some rehearsals going. I'm being slightly apprehensive because I'm saying I really would like to rehearse when I know there's definitely going to be a gig. I don't want to do 10 rehearsals and jam, and even though it'd be lovely to get in a room with people, but there has to be like an end game for it. I would hate to do those 10 rehearsals and then find, well, there's going to be no gigs for another 8 months. So I'm being cautious, I suppose.
But listen, the joy of rehearsing, I personally love it. And it's not financially really that good, but it's just enough for the soul, just to keep the spirits going during these times, you know?
Yeah.
I'm strangely optimistic. Illogically optimistic, but I've had it throughout the COVID thing that I just feel like, yeah, we'll be back gigging in a few weeks. There's no problem.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I just got this blind faith.
But that's, you have to have that.
Yeah.
Like, I inevitably we're going to get back.
But you meet a lot of great musicians and they're doomsdayers, and they meet you and they go, Dave, you're not taking this seriously, or else you're being naive, or else we're fucked, or this is a disaster for all musicians forever, and all this kind of doomsday stuff. And I totally disagree. You know,
yeah.
I think nothing will ever be the same. Of course not. But I think people will definitely be back at festivals, gigs, all that stuff. You know, it'll happen. You know, we've had these plagues and pandemics before through the history of mankind, you know, and I know we're really, really over-focused because of social media mainly, on ourselves at this moment in time, like it's never happened to anyone before, but it has happened, and worse, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, there's the Spanish flu and the Asian flu in the 50s, and so you can go through the list of all the things that happened that took way more lives, you know.
Yeah.
And were absolute tragedies for the human race, but things got good again.
Mm.
You know, so we just got to keep the faith.
Well, tell me this much: when's the vinyl coming out?
The vinyl is at the end of August, International Record Store Day, so it's easy for people to remember. And I'm really proud of it. It's just, if you're a vinyl fan and a music fan, I think it's one for the collection.
Great. Well, I'm going to add links on this post to all your website, your Instagram, your Facebook and all that kind of stuff. We can't get sued. There's nothing we said that's libelous, is it?
Do I care even? What are you going to take? What are you going to sue me for? My drum kits.
Always disover what you said that you'd do when drunk. I don't quite remember what I said that I'd do when drunk. Must have been something. My wheel.